Okay, shall we start? Welcome to the second class. My strategy today, what I hope to achieve at the least today, is to convince you or show you, or at least get you worried, that certain philosophical problems, certain philosophical issues that look very different on the surface and that people treat as very different problems are actually very similar, if not the same. That's my goal for today. My goal on Friday, the next class, will be to try to show you that certain problems that look very similar, maybe the same problem, are actually in certain ways very different. So the two classes, in a way, will go together to form one extended brief. So I'm sorry if we have to stop in the middle today. What I want to try to do today is show you in a little more detail. We started talking about this last class, is to try to show you in a little more detail that certain problems can share a form, that you can have philosophical problems that are apparently about a very different subject matter, a very different content, or come from a very different area of philosophy, but the form of the problem is the same. And if one really sees how similar the form of the problem is, then one starts to see that if a solution of this form didn't work there, it's not going to work here either, for the same reason. Also, if one comes to be able to recognize certain philosophical problems as having the same form, you can save yourself a lot of time in philosophy, because all that work you did over there turns out to be work that has a bearing. What we're going to do next time is to look at philosophical issues on the same topic, on the same content, where people keep talking along, and show how at a certain point the form of the problem has started to change. It's no guarantee that you have the same problem. You've called it the same thing. Say, skepticism about meaning or something. The fact that you have some label that everyone's using that's supposed to guarantee the sharedness of topic doesn't mean that the problem won't change a lot if the form under discussion starts to change. So today we're going to try to, as it were, keep a form fixed and vary the content a bit. Next class, we'll start to vary the form and over cases where the content is common. So that's what we're just going to do for these first two classes as a way of opening out into the much larger topics of the course. It's just the first two classes I'm talking about. The second and third classes, Wednesday and Friday of this week. Now, the kind of skepticism I'm going to be talking about today, and I just want us to focus on today, I'm going to call Cartesian skepticism. One thing we could talk about, and someday should talk about, perhaps, is why I call it Cartesian skepticism. Why this label? Why Cartesian? Most of the philosophical problems we'll be talking about today, Descartes never talked about. So why call this Cartesian skepticism? I think that's a good question. I'd be happy to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it today. So, if the label Cartesian skepticism bothers you, then think of it as the skepticism that we talked about in the class meeting on September 24th, or whatever other label for picking out this kind. As long as you're convinced there's a kind of skepticism that we're looking at across these examples, that's all I need for today. Once we're familiar with the kind and we have it under control, we really understand what we're talking about, then I would be glad to discuss why I think there's a point to giving this historical label to this kind. But let's make sure we know what we're talking about first. Otherwise, in my experience, the discussion doesn't go very well because the topic isn't really shared. Those of you who have started reading the article by me assigned for today also will notice in the first part of that article I discussed something called, I call in that article, Kantian skepticism. I also propose we don't talk about that today. Next class, we can bring that onto the discussion. I'm not trying to avoid either of these topics. I just want us to proceed in a way where we're really making progress. So if you have questions, if you're interested in that, as of Friday class, please feel free to ask questions. Let's just get on top of Cartesian skepticism. So the strategy I want today is to look at something which I want to pick out as a distinctive kind of skepticism, historically very influential, especially starting in the 16th and 17th centuries, increasingly less influential, I think. Also, these are two interesting questions we also won't discuss today, but I'll just mention them. Why, at a certain point, did this kind of skepticism become urgent in the history of philosophy? I think it's a mistake to read it all the way back to the beginning of philosophy. And why is it becoming less urgent or giving way to other things called skepticism without there always being distinguished as different varieties? These are, I think, all good questions, but they're only questions you can ask once you have the phenomena distinguished. So, again, we'll postpone those questions until we distinguish them. But this sort of skepticism we're discussing today, which I will call Cartesian, I want to look at five examples of it. One from the philosophy of, from the area of philosophy called epistemology, but more narrowly from the philosophy of perception, since there are other examples one could take from epistemology. One from the area of philosophy you might call philosophy of mind, but again, more specifically, what's called skepticism about other minds. I think there are other cases one could take from philosophy of mind. One could even wonder whether some of these other cases aren't partly examples of philosophy of mind. Part of what one starts to see here is these areas of philosophy are not so distinct, but there's even a danger of dividing philosophy into areas when one's thinking about these issues. So, philosophy of perception, and there we'll look specifically at the problem of the so-called skepticism about the external world. Here we'll look at skepticism of other minds. Then a case from philosophy of language. Again, there's more than one kind of issue one could look at here. But the one I want to focus on here is a kind of skepticism about one's knowledge of meaning, one's knowledge of what someone means by their words. A kind of case from philosophy of action. The kind of case I want to focus on here has to do with how one knows that an action is intentional, somebody intended it, that it was the kind of thing that could be intended. And finally, a kind of case from aesthetics, where the question is how one knows something is a work of art. Notice, in each one of these cases, I said, how one knows. So that's one of the marks of what I'm calling Cartesian skepticism, is it always concerns one's entitlement to a claim to knowledge. And the structure of Cartesian skepticism, the thing I'm calling Cartesian skepticism, is that the claim to knowledge is always placed under suspicion, a doubt, a ground for doubt is entered. And if the ground for doubt is entered the right way, and one of the things we started talking about last time, we'll talk about more, is what is the right way. But if you can enter the ground for doubt the right way, you don't just take out the initial candidate example of knowledge. It looks like you threaten the whole category of knowledge. Last time I talked about the example of my seeing a bird at 50 feet just before it flies away. And I pointed out, if I turned out to be wrong about that, the conclusion would be Professor Conant was wrong. Well, Professor Conant can't tell blue jays, or Professor Conant has bad eyesight, or Professor Conant doesn't know anything about Norwegian birds. But the conclusion would be like that. That is, its consequences would be extremely local. It wouldn't distrust your knowledge of birds or your eyesight, let alone sensory knowledge as such. So you have to choose the example the right way. But if you choose the example the right way, and you choose the ground for doubt the right way, then you raise a certain kind of skepticism about knowledge. I want to look at a few cases of that. And the reason I'm putting this carefully is because for each of these areas, and in fact, this is part of the source of confusion in philosophy, for each of these labels, skepticism about external world, skepticism about other minds, especially skepticism about meaning, and so forth, there's a rather different kind of a problem you could be worried about that has a different structure. Though people use the same label, because they act as if the label naming the topic, could pick out the structure of the problem. And I think by the end of next class already, we'll see that's not true. It's not just what you're talking about, it's how you're talking about it that gives it its character as a philosophical problem. So what I want to do is just look at these cases and see how we can have problems. So in a way, the goal here is very minimal today. We're starting very slow. It's a way in which I'm not making any philosophical claims myself. Today, all we're doing, in a sense, is a certain kind of descriptive sociology of philosophy. I'm going to just look at problems that people have talked about, some of them, and see how you can have homology of structure across extremely different philosophical topics with respect to this particular structure. That's all we're going to try to see today. But even just seeing that clearly, I think, is useful, because it involves learning to see past, as it were, the clothing of the problem to the real body of it. One other thing is that I think I'll focus. If we really try to talk about all five of these topics in the limited time available to us, I think there's a danger that we won't really get anywhere. So I'm going to sort of weight these topics in this order, too. We'll get the perception case the clearest. We'll spend the most time on it. It's the classic form of the skeptical problem in almost every area. Historically, it's always the one that comes first, which I think is interesting. And then the mind case and the language case. These two cases we'll spend increasingly less time on. We'll just see how the time allows. But at least that you have some flavor. I want to be clear also that I could have chosen other areas of philosophy. I'm not saying something like, here are the five areas in which you can find this problem. In fact, I'm more inclined to saying something like the opposite. You give me an area of philosophy and I will show you a version of this problem. And the same thing for the rather different form of skepticism we'll talk about on Friday again. So two versions of skepticism, that area of philosophy. Or at least two versions. Because there are areas of philosophy called things like philosophy of science. But that doesn't name a particular problem. It names all kinds of philosophical problems that can come up that have something to do with science. So, in fact, many cases. But you will see in the next few weeks as the course goes on that I do have strategic reasons for choosing these five areas. Seeing the similarities and differences across these particular areas, I think, is a very particular way of getting a certain kind of perspicuous overview. So I do have my ulterior motives in these choices. I won't deny that, but they can emerge as we go along. But they are in some sense optional choices. Good. So now let's get down to work. Perception. Cartesian skepticism, perception. Here's the one case where Descartes' text is actually a useful source. He discusses this one. Descartes does. So, if I'm a Cartesian skeptic, first I take an example, what I'll call a best case of knowledge. This phrase, best case of knowledge, let me just say, I'm taking this phrase from the reading from Stanley Cavell's book. If you start reading that, you'll start seeing that I'm actually alluding to a certain discussion of skepticism there. If you're a Cartesian, you want to start with the best case of knowledge. If it's philosophy of perception, you want to start with the best case of perceptual knowledge. Not a goldfinch at 50 feet in a rainy day in Norway if you're an American, it's just right. But something like, you know, classically things like a fireplace, a hand, an envelope, a chair. Or, to take an example we can share right now, that Professor Conan is standing in front of a class. So I am standing in front of a class. The conditions appear to be perfectly optimal. The lighting appears to be fine. I myself, as far as I know, am in perfectly good framework for making condition for making epistemic judgments. I got a fair amount of sleep. I did get kind of wet getting over here, but I'm kind of dry. My eyes are dry. I can get real close. You can see that Dixon's not made out of cardboard. Just looks like a really good case for knowledge. There doesn't seem to be in terms of the normal ways in which one could epistemically exculpate a failure to make a claim of knowledge. Well, I should have looked more closely. Doesn't look very plausible if I turn out to be wrong about my being in a class right now. That my excuse will be, I should have looked more closely. So, best case of knowledge, that's the kind of example you choose here in perception. Perceptual knowledge, my basis for claiming I'm in a class right now. If you ask me, how do you know you're in a class right now? Then I'm going to say something like, because I can see. Yeah, and I can see that I'm in a class. That looks like the form of the answer, if I have to give an answer. That's when skepticism comes, has a possibility of starting, the kind of thing we're interested in, Cartesian skepticism, when the answer has that kind of generality. In the case of perceptual knowledge, because I can see it. If you ask me, how do I know that's a goldfinch at 50 feet away? I say, well, because they have red heads. If that's my ground for knowledge, then already we can't get skepticism going. If you point out that gold crests have red heads as well as goldfinches, the conclusion is going to be, well, I guess he doesn't know. No skepticism. If the ground for knowledge itself is secured at the level of marks of features of that kind of individuated sort. So the skeptic needs to construct the example in such a way that the person who makes the claim is going to give the right kind of ground. So if that ground collapses, there's trouble. In the case of perceptual knowledge, we want the ground to be something like, because I can see it, because I can hear it. Then, the skeptic needs to cause trouble for this ground. I say, best case, I'll give you a best case of knowledge. If I'm Gene Moore, I walk right into the skeptic's trap and I say, here is a hand. Or, I'm in front of a class. There's a case of knowledge for sure. The skeptic says, how do you know? I say, well, because I can see I'm in front of a class. Now, what does the Cartesian skeptic do? What does he say next? Does he say, oh, you're right, you can see it, sorry. You must know it. Will, because I can see it, shut up the Cartesian skeptic? What's he going to do next? Dixon, you next.
Maybe I'll show you that your eyes are not deceiving you.
I'll show you that?
Your eyes are not deceiving
you. My eyes. Because of my eyesight?
Maybe dreaming or something.
Right. See, good. Dreaming, I think, is like the way Descartes goes. It's worth noticing the difference. If it's something wrong with my eyesight, and it just turns out to be, look, Jim, or Professor Conant, you know that you have trouble with these new prescription glasses. And in fact, I do. I just got them. They're bifocals. Then the conclusion is going to be, I should get new glasses. No skepticism. So yeah, so it's very important that the ground for doubt doesn't seem to go through the wrong level of particularity about me, say. But if he says, dreaming, now we've got something going, but why does dreaming matter? What is the structure of the argument from dreaming? How does dreaming cause trouble for my claim? Yes?
The fact of being indistinguishable from real sensation. But actually, we passed somehow through the last class with other examples than the dreaming metaphor.
Many. I mean, the classic one is, I think the dreaming one works particularly well. But let's see how the dreaming one works, and then look at some other examples. But yeah, I think there are lots of ways to do it. But the crucial thing you need is just what you said. That's what the other examples have to do. Is the thing that you just said, the dreaming example does. That is, they have to allow the skeptic to be able to say, here's a case that would be indistinguishable, sensorily or sensuously indistinguishable from the case you're now in. But if you're in that other situation, then you wouldn't be standing in front of a class. And since you cannot now distinguish your present case from that case, He might be in the situation you say, but you don't know that you're standing in front of class. Because you're only in a position to know that you're standing in class if you can exclude that possibility. So he brings up not just a possibility. There's much confusion about this, I think, in the literature about skepticism. What the skeptic does is not something so cheap as to just bring up a bizarre possibility. And then you can say, well, and so some of the literature is in blocking skepticism about how bizarre possibilities should be excluded. But the skeptic's strategy is not just to bring up a bizarre possibility. His possibilities often are bizarre, but that's not, as it were, the crucial thing about them. The more plausible, the better. But the crucial thing about them is what you said, which is he brings up a scenario such that if you were in that scenario rather than the one you claim to be in, you, from your present position, could not tell the difference. In the case of dreaming, the way this works is Descartes will say, I have often dreamed, and my dreams have been very, very convincing. And then I woke up to discover that I wasn't in the situation I'm in. So I might right now be dreaming that I am in front of a classroom. And if I were to wake up a moment from now, I would discover that I was wrong, that I wasn't in front of a classroom. So, in a sense, the crucial phrase in the Descartes quotation here, as I said, it depends on your translation, is when Descartes says, there are no marks or features by which we can distinguish dreaming from waking states. The skeptic is always interested in creating, the Cartesian skeptic, excuse me, is always, let's just say for today, when I say the skeptic, I mean the Cartesian skeptic. You'll find out next week, I think that's not all the skeptic means, but just for today, the skeptic means the Cartesian skeptic. So when the Cartesian skeptic is always trying to create a situation in which there's reality and illusion. But the pair, the real case, the veridical case, and the illusory case, are constructed in such a way that there are no marks or features that pick out the real case. So, the structure is going to be, if right now I am dreaming, and then it's very tempting to say something like this. You don't usually say it, but let's make it explicit. The thought is something like, from within, I cannot tell. So the idea is, I'm inside my experience. There's an inside and an outside. And the external world is outside my experience. And then if you make the assumptions even more explicit, what we see is that the structure of the argument is, my experience, the thing I have from within, standing in front of a classroom, could itself have the same character regardless of what's going on in the outside. Usually, when I have an experience of this character being in front of a classroom, what's going on the outside, inside and outside are in quotes here, nobody actually says this, I'm trying to bring out a picture. Or maybe they say this, but they don't have to say it. They don't usually say it. But what's going on in the outside corresponds to what's going on inside. But it could be completely different. And what was going on in the inside would be the same. So there is an idea of the experience as mediating the knowledge. The thing I want to know is beyond the reach of the experience. Then I need to make a conclusion. So you always have the idea in Cartesian skepticism, we'll see this in other cases, of it looking like I need to make an inference. An inference, in this case, from my sensory experience to how things are. The inference I want to make is, when things appear in the best case, or Descartes says, when I have clear and distinct ideas, when the best case, when things appear to me thus and so, then I can conclude they are thus and so. The structure is always one where it looks like I need an inference from a certain situation, here the sensory experience, to the conclusion, whether things are as the experience represents them. And then the Cartesian always blocks the inference by showing you that you could have a case just like the case you're in, as far as you can tell on the inside, but the conclusion doesn't follow. So we had two hands. And Michael, and then...
Okay, yes. I was thinking about this a lot yesterday, and I think you can re-problematize Descartes' argument very easily.
You can what?
Make it more complex. We can problematize it. Make it a problem. Because at first sight, it looks that it's breaking totally with common sense by having doubt over everything. But at least in Descartes' argument, he is distinguishing between reality and dream, and he gives the impression to know that a dream is less real than reality. So how can you know that?
I think you said a lot very fast there. But let me just clarify a few things. First of all, what I'm trying to do in today's class is, I'm not trying to defend Descartes or criticize him, or actually defend or criticize any of these other forms of skepticism. All I want us to do today is see that there are some forms of skepticism, whether you like them or not, whether you want to hold your nose as you listen to them or not. And just notice the similarity in structure. I think there's something to be gained. So that's all we're doing. We are going to, in a few classes, start to criticize these forms of skepticism. But I want us to understand what we're criticizing before we criticize. So I really meant, today we're, and next class, our goal is description. Then we can start in criticism. But let me also just say a couple other things to what you said. In this kind of skepticism, you're not doubting everything. It's very important. There's a lot you're not doubting. This is sort of, in a sense, the point of Descartes' cogito. In particular, you're not doubting your knowledge of how things appear to you. If I'm a Cartesian skeptic about perception, and you ask me, do you know that it appears to you? Slightly more strange way of speaking, but let me have it. Do you know that it appears to you that you're in a class? Yes, I do. That I cannot doubt. So it's part of the strategy of Cartesian skepticism, in each of these cases we'll see, to divide things into the category of the dubitable and the indubitable. One of the things you're doing is doubting. And you're always finding there's some things you can't doubt. And then it looks like what you need to do is infer from the stuff you can't doubt to the thing you really wanted. In this case, we cannot doubt that things appear to us a certain way. But the thing we really want, it looks like, if we're doing philosophy of perception, is not knowledge of how things appear to us, but how knowledge of how things are. And then the problem he shows us, or wants to show us, this kind of skeptic, is we don't have a surefire inference from the one to the other. So you're absolutely right, you're not doubting everything. Now, that distinction between no problem at all about how things appear to me, big problem about how things are beyond the appearances, that feature of this kind of skepticism, we'll see, is not at all the way things work with the kind of skepticism we'll talk about on Friday. That itself is a crucial feature of Cartesian skepticism. Another way of putting this is to say that in Cartesian skepticism, in any form of Cartesian skepticism, you always have a gap. And if I had to give you one feature of Cartesian skepticism to look for, if you want to look and see if it's Cartesian skepticism, I would say, look for the gap. And there's always a gap. Here the gap is from the inside of my mind to the world. I'm on the mind side, I want to get to the world side. I can't doubt the things that are on my side of the gap. In Cartesian skepticism, are always taken to be completely unproblematic. If you will, in this case, the mental stuff. And then, the stuff on the far side of the gap, in this case, the worldly stuff, if you want, the physical stuff, is problematic. But that's always the structure. Cartesian skepticism is not, in a certain sense, radical. If what you think it means to be radical is to doubt everything you could doubt. In that sense, Cartesian skeptics are not radical. They're always saying, oh, there's a lot you can't doubt. The problem is you can't get from there to this place you wanted to go. I mention this because people often think the point of Cartesian skepticism is the doubt is so radical. Well, compared to what? Radical is relative. Compared to someone who doesn't doubt, it's radical. Compared to other kinds of skepticism, Cartesian skepticism, very structure depends upon there being two sides of a gap, no problem on the near side, big problem about the far side. That's the structure of it. But we will say much more about this issue that you raised, Mihail, about is there a problem about assuming that we know what we dream? That problem will come back. But that problem is not itself a problem as the Cartesian skeptic himself sees as a problem. So I don't want to talk about it today. Because today I just want to describe what different Cartesian skeptics think. Once we have that under control, we can turn around and think about what we think about what they think. Did you tell me your name?
Yeah.
I better write that down.
Say. Jacob.
R-E-A?
Ula, O-L-E.
I don't know what Ula is. Is that an Ula? O-H-L-E? O-L-E?
Yeah.
Ola Jacob, like that?
Yeah.
Or maybe with a K? Like that? Okay, sorry. Excuse my ignorance of Norwegian names.
You talk about Mark's future. But why can't this mark be time? It's like they talk all these marks that you can distinguish dreams and...
if you wait long enough.
Yeah, because it seems that he doesn't account that time can be one of these marks.
Well... again, just to flag something, I'll say something that, and just not to be rude. But again, if we want to say, is there a problem with this kind of skepticism? If you want to know my view, the answer is yeah. There's a lot of things we can say criticism. My goal at the moment is not to convince you Cartesian skepticism. It's to give you a bunch of cases of skepticism to see how they're similar. But so I do think we can criticize this, but. It's not, if you want to bring time in, you're going to have to do it carefully. If it's just that, because otherwise, it's going to look like, okay, I'll wait 10 minutes. But I've had dreams that are longer than 10 minutes. As soon as we get this kind of thing, if we have a good skeptic, you know, once we get it longer, the skeptic will also point out that memory sometimes deceives us too. So, you know, the more time that goes forward, as we're trying to make sure that no dream was ever that long, you can start wondering, well, do I remember what happened? And have I forgotten that dream? I think it's extremely hard to break this kind of... I mean, if you keep it local enough, you can maybe think you have an answer. But as long as you grant the fact that you can construct a case of this sort, was there ever a case where you were sure you were right about something? That this had never happened? But then someone said, yes, oh, I was wrong. So the problem is, the kind of argument you'll get into with a skeptic will be one in which you have to be able to say, now, after it takes place for 1 hour, it's longer than any dream, but shorter than any period during which I haven't misremembered something. And I wonder how, you know, satisfying the answer to skepticism that is. I mean, it's going to start looking like it turns on quantitative features of length of time. Maybe you think 1 hour is too short and the answer should be 1 week. No, but it doesn't matter. I mean, as soon as you see that you have an argument that turns on the quantity of the time, it won't be satisfying. So the way you have to bring time in can't just be quantity. Now, having said that, one thing we'll talk about briefly in a few weeks from now is Kant's critique of Descartes in The Refutation of Idealism. And that argument has everything to do with time. So Kant certainly thinks that by thinking about your ability to order things in time, not how long the dream is, but your ability to order things in time, if you think about that ability carefully, that's going to create problems for Descartes. Could you order things in time without having any relation to things in space? That's the question Kant asks, which in turn is very important for contemporary analytic philosophy and people like Strawson and Evans and so forth. So at that point, you have an argument against a certain kind of conception of the Cartesian inner in which time plays a crucial role in criticizing Descartes. But we'd have to think about how we appeal to time. If it's just wait longer, that's how time answers. I wonder how convincing that would be. But I think you're right, that time could play a role in the argument. But again, I think we shouldn't get into that now. I think what we should do right now is just look at some kinds of Cartesian skepticism. So, yes?
Going back to the phrase variety,
yes?
I want to just read something from Cartesian
skepticism. Yes, thank you.
Is it being skeptic about how things appear to us or how things really are?
Right. The Cartesian skeptic is not doubting how things appear at all. In fact, the Cartesian skeptic is taking that to, in some sense, be self-evident, self-intimating. You just open your eyes and you know how things appear. How things are, whether things are as they appear. That's the question in Cartesian skepticism. So, one of the signs is Cartesian skepticism, if you're reading a philosopher, if you want to know what kind of problematic he has. One of the signs that it's a Cartesian problematic is that it's very hard for them to avoid some word like real, or really, or actual. Those words are usually sort of often, they don't have to be, there are other ways to say it, but those are usually, as it were, the symptoms of a Cartesian problematic, you know. Well, I know it appears that we're in a classroom, but how do we know we really are? You know, there's a certain kind of philosophical problem that has the form. That's the Cartesian problem. That's the question. We all can agree, of course. I mean, it's overwhelmingly likely that, you know, we are all right in thinking. I mean, the chances of us all being asleep. But, of course, you wouldn't actually exist if I'm asleep. So then, you know, the chances of my being wrong about this are very... But that's not the issue. The issue is, how do I know this is really the case? And so it's always one, not of appearances, or even of probabilities, but how can I exclude with certainty? That word certainty is the complement of really here. You often get that word in Cartesian discussions. So it looks like one of the conditions on knowledge is that, you know, I have a certain kind of certainty, that I know my justification isn't pretty good or usually right, but that my justification actually secures the knowledge. So the issue is always one of knowledge. I'll summarize that in a moment, yes?
Yeah. I'm trying to find these formulas, doesn't that? This
right. We haven't said much about it. I was about to say something about that, but go ahead. Yeah,
yeah, my question is, wouldn't be right to say that the Cartesian then always a realist for the discourse that wants to make the skeptical problem for, and that the gap is between the truth conditions and the cardinal verificatory method for the truth-value distribution of the statements of the relevant discourse?
That's way too fast. I would say something like this. You only get, you know, first of all, I think one of the things I'll try to say, maybe after the next class, is realism, anti-realism themselves can name more than one issue. I think those are words that are exactly as unclear as skepticism. The word skepticism turns out to have varieties, then realism will have varieties too. But there are issues of realism and anti-realism here. One kind of realist will say, yes, there really is a world. So that kind of realist is trying to answer the skeptic by saying, there is a world, and this is how we can know there is. And in fact, in that sense of metaphysical realist, Descartes was held to be a metaphysical realist. He thought, you get God into the conversation the right sort of way, and you have the right sort of argument about why God must exist, and you have the right sort of argument about why he is benevolent, and must be benevolent, and then we have these clear and distinct ideas, and we realize we can trust those clear and distinct ideas. And therefore, although from within, we can't tell whether our ideas match the world, we know there's a sideways on point of view from which the world and our ideas must match, and we know there's a God who created us so there would be a match, so we can rely on them. It's essentially an argument that though from within our design we can't tell, we can tell and know that we are reliably designed. So Descartes is a kind of realist and was called a metaphysical realist. That's, in a sense, the classical kind of realism. What people mean by realism in 20th century philosophy, I think, has changed. But people aren't often clear about this. That's one of the things we'll start being able to talk about next week. There's a kind of anti-realism here, too, of which Berkeley is perhaps the first great example. That example says, you know, we can't get to that world. Descartes, in the first meditation, was doing really well. He showed there was a problem. And then he pretended he could solve it. But in fact, all we have are these sensory ideas. We can't have more than sensory ideas. You know what it is to be in a class? You know what it is to be in front of a class? It's to have a certain set of sensory ideas, which are arranged a certain kind of way. And Berkeley brings time in and says, and if they continue to be arranged a certain way over time, the sensory ideas continue to cohere, that's all there is to being in a class. You don't need something behind the ideas, the class. You take away all the sensory ideas, there's nothing left. So Descartes is the first example of a kind of anti-realism. I think it's a very different kind of anti-realism than we have now in the debates between, say, Dumont and Wright. But it's a kind of anti-realism. With the anti-realists, so in the Cartesian situation, what the realist is someone who's going to say, we can get to the far side of the gap. Let me show you how to build the bridge. So realists tend to be, in the Cartesian, problematic. So Cartesian skepticism here is now just not... When I started out saying Cartesian skepticism, I'm talking about the skeptic. I was talking about someone who had a certain kind of doubt. But now I'm talking about a whole problematic that comes out of the doubt. And in the Cartesian problematic, the realist is someone who says, we can build a bridge across to the far side of the gap. We can have a kind of reliable knowledge about what's going on over there, even though we're stuck over here. Even though we're stuck inside our mind, we can use that material to bootstrap ourselves to knowledge of the world. The anti-realist in the Cartesian problematic is someone who says, no, the skeptic is right about something. You can't get over there. But it's not so bad. Skeptic makes it sound terrible. Oh, we can't get over there. But the answer is we don't need to go over there. That's a big nothing. Actually, what knowledge of being in a class is a matter of having certain kinds of ideas arranged a certain kind of way. That's enough. So the anti-realist tries to answer the skeptic by accepting his problem, but saying you can do it. And Descartes himself was an example in that sense of a realist in the Cartesian problematic. In the Cartesian problematic, the anti-realist is someone who says, well, I agree with you against the realist that we can't get to the far side of the gap, but I don't agree with your conclusion that therefore we can't have knowledge of the appropriate sort, knowledge of whether you're in a class and so forth. You have bought into the realist's conception of how much we need. And some of that, everything I just said, will be the same when we look at other kinds of realism and anti-realism, and some of it will be different. We'll have to wait and see. So this is the beginning of a problematic. And similarly, I might add, for each of these cases of Cartesian skepticism, and similarly, I might add next Friday, for each of these cases of non-Cartesian skepticism, we need to get a bit of an overview. Yes?
In both those cases, you did maintain the gap between objective conditions and identification of truth value distributions as statements. Even though you called them unrealist and unrealist, you assumed the gap in the beginning.
Now, what Berkeley says, I'm trying not to get into things that will distract us. I think the very idea of truth value distributions already actually presupposes a non-Cartesian construal of the problem. But I don't want to argue that right now. We need to see more. It's already turning into a different way of thinking about the problem. It's not a Cartesian problem anymore, I think. But what Berkeley says is not... Berkeley's position is not that there are material substrata and ideas, but we should settle for the ideas, because we can't get there. That's not Berkeley's position. Berkeley's position is that all being a thing is having certain ideas. There isn't any more to the idea. Descartes' notion of the external world is a notion of a nothing. Descartes' notion of what reality is, the thing he wants knowledge of outside his mind, cannot be. Berkeley's position can be summed up in two sentences. There are two things, spirits and there are ideas. That's a quote. That's a kind of anti-realism. It's not assuming the gap. It is denying the other side of the gap. In that sense, it is a kind of anti-realism. But it's a different kind. A word we might be able to introduce later is phenomenalism. It's a kind of phenomenalism. And in that sense, we can see various things that are called anti-realisms that have very different structures as being species of the genus phenomenalism. But that's, again, for a few classes from now. I'm sorry if I'm frustrating people by not going straight to particular issues, but I think there's a benefit going slowly and making sure we really understand the structure of the issues. Yes?
Since you begin with this case,
yes.
Since you have this gap,
yes.
How do you know that this is a best case of no?
Well, I mean, if you're a skeptic, what you should say is, you know, putative best case of knowledge. What happens is the person who's putting it forward is not the skeptic; it's the interlocutor. You know, it's someone saying, you know, the skeptic says there is no such thing as knowledge external. And you say, yes, there is. And then the temptation is to reach for a certain kind of case. And that's when the trouble is. So the skeptic's not going to say, this is the best case of knowledge, because the skeptic is trying to show you, there is nothing which is such a case of knowledge. So in that sense, this is misleading terminology. As you'll see in a couple of weeks again, when we start talking about this, I think this is a totally problematic description of these cases for a variety of reasons. So I don't actually, it's part of why these quotations or marks are here. I don't mean to be buying into this description, but I'm trying to, as it were, capture a certain phenomenology of the philosophical recital. If we try to describe it innocently, in the terms in which it unfolds, if we're just trying to describe Cartesian skepticism without being too critical of it, this appears to be what happens. You don't introduce a bird at 50 feet away. You introduce something that looks like a really good case of knowledge. That's what I meant by best case. Can't think of a better one right now. If I could, I'd choose that one instead. And then a doubt is entered. A ground for knowledge is entered, because I can see it. A ground for doubt for that basis is entered. It always has the structure of, but such and such a case is indistinguishable from the one you put forward. In this sense, to borrow a phrase, it always has the general form of an argument from illusion. The skeptic, the Cartesian skeptic, is always going to say, but you could be in a situation that appears just like that, but it's an illusion. And then it looks like that's what induces the gap. Because then it looks like the illusory case and the real case are indistinguishable. Then it looks like the basis for the knowledge falls short of the thing you want to know. And at that time, at that moment, the thing you want to know looks like it's on the other side of a gap. In this case, the gap is the mind, and there are different kinds of mental experiences you can have. The experience of dreaming of a certain sort, the experience of being in a classroom, actually being in a classroom and seeing something. And then there's the fact of the matter you want, being in the class. And it looks like the two things are on one side, experiences in the mind. The thing you want to know is outside the mind. And it looks like there's no way from within that you can distinguish the illusory from the vertical case. And then it looks like you have to conclude, I don't know. That's the structure here. So, there's two questions that came up earlier I postponed and I want to answer. One was Paul's question about the form. Yeah, what is the form? I haven't really said much about that. And there was your question about, well, what else besides dreaming? So, let's just get to those two questions now. So, there'll be more to say about the form. I think it's easier to really discuss in detail the form of a kind of skepticism when you have more than one example. And you can contrast them and see how they're different. Just like any other two things, if I ask you to describe something, it's helpful. But let's try to say some things about the form right now, even though we only have one case, based on what we've said. All of the following features will belong to Cartesian skepticism if it's a full-blown case. We start with the best case. So we have a certain kind of example. We have to choose the example right. A doubt is entered about that case. The doubt is such that it raises a worry that there is a situation that is indistinguishable from our present situation, but wouldn't be a case in which we could claim to know if we were in that situation. Then what happens, another feature of the form we haven't talked about very much, but notice, what you conclude then is not, I guess I don't know, I'm in front of a class, like the bird case. Then what you conclude is, I don't know this. Then I never know whether things are as they appear. It's a very important feature of Cartesian skepticism, that you start with an example. It looks like you're talking about the example for a bit, and then the bottom falls out. You have a moment where it's, if I don't know this, I never know. Things of this sort. Descartes doesn't conclude the first meditation by saying, I have shown that when I think I'm in a dressing gown in front of the fireplace, I don't know it. Now let's move on to pants and shirts, and pants and shirts in front of dining tables, and so forth. He doesn't need to do that. So, if I don't know this, I never know. So you go from a particular case to a precipitous general doubt. But it seems like the right conclusion. It's not, one doesn't want to say about the skeptic, oh, he's committed a fallacy. He's concluded from I sometimes know to I never know. It looks like the structure of the example is so basic. If you don't know that, who cares about the bird at 50 feet? So that's a further feature of the form. I think next class, in the class after, we can start talking about more features of the form. But that's already, if you have those features, you can start, I think, to see what the character of this form is. We'll give you more features. Well, maybe one other feature I'll mention, because it's come up already, is that once you have this doubt that's structured in this way, then you have a gap. That feature is maybe worth mentioning. You have a gap which you need to bridge and you cannot bridge. And I'll even say something else, which might not be very obvious now, but turns out to be quite important. The two sides of the gap always have a certain kind of character. It's a little hard to get this general. But on one side of the gap, we always have the world as, we might say, something like, we want to say now something like, as it is in itself. So, the world described merely physically. Are described as a merely natural set of events or objects. And on the other side of the gap, we always have something that is structured the way the mind is structured. It involves thoughts, intentions, beliefs, appearances, representations, experiences. Things that human subjects can have. Things that could be true or false, or that could be fulfilled or frustrated, to have the structure of, in that sense, expectations or beliefs or wishes or intentions. The two sides of the gap always have that structure. Which side of the gap you're on and which side you're trying to get to, that can change, as we'll see in a moment. But the two sides of the gap always have the feature that there are the way things are, and then there's other things we're trying to connect with the way things are, that have the structure of a thought, or an intention, or something a human subject can enjoy. Only a thinking, representing being. In Descartes' language, only a res cogitans could have one of those. And then the question is, how do you connect that bit of res extensa with that bit of res cogitans? That's always the problem, Cartesian skepticism. Whether you have the details of Descartes' ontology, or whether you're much more modern, and you're talking in terms of quantum mechanics, and some really complicated theory of representation, the problem still has that structure. So that's a further feature of the form, which is very particular. But let's see some more examples.